Kia ora koutou, hello and welcome to this edition of Sky Sports Playmakers, a course where we catch up with the character or legend of the game. The next gentleman I'm going to talk to today, All Black number 854, is absolutely both of those, and I've never met an individual with more passion for more things than Sir John Kerwin. JK, thanks for joining us. I'm intrigued by this conversation. I have no idea where it's going to go. But I suppose, where do we start? I want to start with three things. De La Salle College, Marist and Auckland Rugby. Those three things, what did they do for you as a rugby player in person?
Hey Goldie, nice to be here. Changed my life, completely changed my vision, changed what I thought of myself. So, got to remember De La Salle College, not very good at school, some learning issues that I found out later in my life, but rugby sort of gave me everything. So De La Salle first 15 halfback, and then making the Auckland team. And obviously John Hart had a big part of that. He was a mutual friend of ours. And then the whole world just opened up. And so I wouldn't be half the person I am today without those scary often moments where you're forced to change and forced to look at yourself and forced to take an opportunity, you know?
What did club rugby mean in the 1980s? What did Auckland rugby mean, given the fact that we know that maybe the enemy of the whole of the country, because you guys had got so good? I mean, what did it mean for you? What did the club scene mean for you?
The club scene was belonging. Back in our day, you had a club and mainly had it for life, unless you moved towns. For me, being brought up in the Catholic faith, it was a pretty easy decision to go to Marist. So for me, it was about that belonging. And really, the beautiful thing about club rugby back then was no one was any different. And then if you got selected to Auckland, it was just this, you're sitting around a changing room and there's the builder, the lawyer, all the different professions. And if you were good at rugby, then you got selected to the next level, but you kept coming back. I mean, we'd train Tuesdays and Thursdays with Marist, and we'd train Monday, Wednesday with Auckland. And I remember playing one of my first test matches against France in 1984 and flying back Sunday morning and playing for Marist on Sunday afternoon. And that's just what you did. You know, that wasn't anything out of the norm.
Let's talk about the juggernaut, though, that was Auckland Rugby in the late 80s and early 90s, and as well through the mid-90s in terms of Super Rugby. I mean, did it feel like a juggernaut at the time? Did you feel as though the rest of the country was against you?
It was. I don't think there's a lot more animosity at the moment, I think, against Auckland. But at the time, I think John Hart, I believe that great sides see the future and understand what the game might look like and then select accordingly. And I certainly think John Hart felt that the game needed to go through a transition, and that transition was keeping the ball alive. It was really easy for me because he just gave me one job, just stay on your feet and hand it off to people like Michael Jones. In my first year, the Iceman wasn't there, but that was his vision. His vision was to keep the game going, make people run a lot more, wear down the opposition. And so I think what he did have was a vision, and then we all bought into that. And then we had this balance of young and old, which I think is really, really important at the time. And a lot of us were impatient. We wanted to be the best in the world. We wanted to take this opportunity to sort of better ourselves. And so I think it was that sort of dynamic combination. We'd go around the country and there was a love-hate for sure, but that just motivated us. And when you look around Auckland, it's interesting, we get criticised because a lot of the people sitting around that change room weren't from Auckland, so...
So which players set the tone? When you first got on the team, which guys were the ones that you knew were the ones that had the mana that you had to follow, or the ones that maybe you had to stand up to and challenge from time to time?
Oh, Andy Hayden was an amazing influence in my early years, and you know, he really shaped the way I thought. Totally against anything that was, you know, that he didn't feel was right or correct. Ahead of his time from professionalism point of view, so he was a professional back then, just trying to hide it in case he didn't get banned. Really, really opinionated, really, really strong personality. So you had to stand up to him, otherwise, you know, you would you'd get trodden on. John Drake, incredibly influential. I mean, my first season, he walks in a month late, right? And he's been living in France. And, you know, he was the first prop that really acted like a back, you know, like loved the good things in life. And he was telling me about France. And so he was incredibly influential. My good mate Fitzy would sort of come up the grades together. You know, I was the butcher and he was the builder, you know. And so we had this common drive. So he was very good for me to have by my side. Grant Fox, completely demanding. Him and I are absolutely great mates, but two different personalities, just demanding excellence every single day. Joe Stanley, you know, one of the first sort of fantastic Pacifica players of note, probably after Brian Williams. And, you know, he brought very much a different look at it. So Lindsay Harris, one of the greatest fullbacks I ever played with, Goldie, and yeah, just a really, really interesting character. So it was made up with all, and I'm leaving out all of them because I think back then, you know, there was no one thing that happens with professional players now is they get institutionalized, right? So they know how they should do, they know what they should say. You often see it in the media, but you also see it you know, as humans, and it's not their fault. It's just what I call being institutionalized. There was none of that, you know, none of that nowadays. Everyone had their opinion. Everyone had an argument. There was nothing personal about it, but it was just way more dynamic.
And we're still arguing with Foxy now, let's be honest. He's still demanding. It's just the nature of, like you say, players and people don't change. You talk about the good life. While you're doing this, though, you started to spend some off seasons in Treviso and in Italy. And your good friend Craig Green was there. And let's talk about that, about how that maybe has shaped not just your culture and understanding of so many things, but also your personal life. Was that probably one of your best memories of the game, was making that trip overseas? Oh, there it is.
See that?
Well, I can see that.
That's my Italian passport. Yeah. So there I go. I'm an Italian citizen, believe that or not, you know, from Mangere to just outside Venice. Yeah, look, I think it was an incredible time. So I actually went before. So 89, we won the competition, and there I was with Craig Green. But I actually went in 1985 when I was 20. And it was the most, it was a really tough time. It was an interesting journey. I'm at training one night. And there's this guy who's probably dressed like I dress now, Goldie. You know, he had jeans on, a shirt. And then the guy standing next to him was in jeans and a jacket, and he had long hair and in a ponytail, right? So this is 1985. And after training, they came up to him and they said, "Oh, JK, we'd like you to come to Italy." And I went, "Wow, yeah, that's really interesting. And we've got a budget of $3,000, right?" I was earning $600 for my dad a month, and they had $3,000 a month, right? So I'm getting $150 a week or whatever it was. And that was 90 in normal pay. And then I was boning beef at $10 a body to make extra money, right? So $3,000, I go straight home to dad and go, you know, "These guys, Dad, are going to pay me $3,000 a month to go and play rugby." And Dad said, "What'd they look like?" And I went, "Well, one was dressed in jeans and had a blazer on, and the other one had long hair and a ponytail." And he said, "Don't trust the bastards, mate."
I thought he might have said cash up front. I thought he might have said
exactly. So he said, "You need to do way more research, because, you know, that's a pretty big risk." So I go and do a whole lot more research. And how it came about was early you know, early in the piece, sort of 72, 73, early 80s, players were starting to go. And a very good friend of mine who was an outstanding number eight for Auckland, tough as nails, is a guy called Glenn Rich. And he'd been over there and they were friends of his and they wanted me to go. And so, you know, I did all this research and I went home and I said to Dad, Dad, you know, it's true. They actually work for the Benetton company. The Benetton family is one of the biggest clothing companies in Europe. So the money's real and it's pretty much guaranteed. And he went, okay, I think you should go, but that's too much money for you. So you can take your sister and your brother-in-law and give them half. So that's what I did. So that's what I did. So my brother-in-law, John Arcoy, who played for Samoa, yeah, he came and played for the local, another local club, gave them half the money. And that's when I got introduced to clothes and wine. And, you know, it was just like this. I went over there the first time. And so you got to remember, brought up in Mangere, meat and three vegetables, son of a butcher. So, you know, there's not a lot of vegan discussions in our house. She was meat and three veggies. Dad would come home and have a lion red in the evening or, you know, a whiskey on the rocks. And mum would have a Cook's Azure out of the cask, you know. Yeah. So I fly into Venice and I get picked up and I have this amazing dinner where they start with a, you know, pivo. They're the first course, then the second course, then the third course, and then the second, third course, and then the next course. And every course, they're bringing out wine. And I'm going, wow, this is like, I've died and gone to heaven. And I won't even mention the amount of beautiful people I saw once I got to the airport. So we won't even go there. But and I thought, man, that was beautiful of them to put on that sort of spread and, you know, that dinner and sort of go through that process with me. Wasn't anything to do with me, mate. It was like that every night.
But, but that's obviously changed you, because if you go to the Kirwan household now, that's the experience that you want to pass on to everyone else. Was that one decision, that one opportunity, was that well and truly life-changing?
Oh, totally. Totally life-changing. And I completely fell in love with the culture, with the people, with the way they did things, with the way they showed emotion. You know, like it was just this amazing transformation for me. And like my family's in Italy at the moment. I spoke to them yesterday. I said, how was your day? And they said, well, you know, we had lunch and these people came round and then other people came round. And anyway, lunch ended up being dinner. And so they were at the dinner table from 1 till 10. So depending on the quality of the food, that's just actually how we entertain and how we stay together as a family and how the Italians really live. And I just fell in love with that. And I came back and people would say things like, What are you doing, JK? Like, you know, you're risking your All Black career. You're only 20. Why are you going? And I was going, are you kidding me? Like, this is the greatest thing I've ever done. And so for me, it was just something that I really wanted to have in my life. They wouldn't let me go the following year because World Cup was coming up. So they all just sort of said to me you know, if you go, okay, we won't pick you for the World Cup. So I didn't go 87, and then I couldn't go at the end of 87. So Craig Green went, and then I went in 89, and we won the championship, and then I went back 1991, 92.
And it's almost like Craig Green hasn't left, right?
Craig, yes. I spoke to Greeno yesterday. Yeah, he's still there. We have a group of old players from Benetton who... Giorgio Piazza. So Giorgio Piazza means square. Yep. So we actually call him Giorgio Square. And he's got a vineyard. And every year we used to go there and just try every vat, basically, and have a massive meal. And they were doing that the other night. So I was pretty pretty sad not to be there. But Greeno was there representing me, as he does.
So I know from experience you're competitive, but... were you always that passionate about things before you started experience, or was it in New Zealand because we didn't do things like that? that all of a sudden bring out and change your personality a little bit in terms of that passion? Or was it just more from the competitiveness to a passion and drive?
It's a great question, Goldie, because I often take time to reflect, and reflection is something that gets taken away from us in the modern world. So actually sitting down and reflecting, and, you know, I've been reflecting about what you and I do on The Breakdown, and sometimes how I'm so passionate and opinionated, and how that could offend or rub people up the wrong way. But I was this incredibly shy South Auckland boy who didn't really like himself, who was full of doubt, and I was lucky that I had the ability of rugby. And I think going through, especially my illness, I came out the other end saying that I want to be values-based, but I also want to be passionate about something, and more, not just one thing, but many things. And if I'm passionate about it, I want to be able to have discussions, because I don't think I'm right. But when I have an opinion, I get really passionate about it. And then if the other person pushes back, then I reflect and will change, as you will know, because you and I have often had those discussions. But I also don't think you can't go through life without having passions. And I think having more than one passion is important, because it gives your life balance. You know, one thing that scares me about rugby is empathy, right? If people don't care, then that's the beginning of the death of your game. And I'm really passionate about us having opinions, and I don't believe that I'm right in any way, but I will be passionate about that decision and arguing it, hoping that I'm going to get that relationship back. I mean, you know, it's never personal for me, but I love a good discussion about almost anything.
Yep, you should
Because that gives me human connection. It gives me a different idea. It means that other person's got just a stronger view, and I think that's really healthy. But so not in our culture, right?
In some ways we like to be understated. We like to sit back. But I'm with you. I do love a great debate and discussion. And, you know, people will forever ask me what Sir John Kerwin like. And I give him exactly what you've just said about the fact that you like to challenge, you like to understand, you like to study. And the great thing about it is when we get in a debate and a discussion, you're not afraid to then admit, maybe I'm wrong here, or I need to change my thought processes on something, which I think is really, really important. And when people ask me about you, and we tend to talk about your All Black career, and we talk about, for example, let's talk about the All Blacks. Then, say 1987, you win a Rugby World Cup. Is that your greatest moment as an All Black, or is there something else besides that that stands out as being more important?
It's like I have a past that's not me. I don't know if you've ever felt like this, but I actually do not look too far into the past. Like, I think there were some really defining moments in my life. You know, one of them was getting picked out of the third grade and you know, what we talked about in the beginning. Another incredibly big moment in my life was going to live in Italy when I was 20. Another incredible moment in my life was winning the World Cup in 1987, but being part of the first World Cup that accelerated. 1989, win the championship for Benetton after 50-odd years, and also meet my wife. So, you know, incredible moment. And the interesting thing that glues us all together is rugby. That's why, I owe the game so much. You know, I had my first sort of major three-week anxiety attack breakdown in Italy at the beginning of that season. Finished the season, greatest night of my life. I'm in love. And I start heading back to New Zealand. I'm in Venice Airport. I walk through customs. They've got guns and all that sort of stuff. Have a massive anxiety attack, and related that anxiety attack to New Zealand and the pressure I was under in New Zealand. So decided never to come back. Turned around, went back out. Got through customs, believe it or not, went back out, and there was no one there. So all the people that had dropped me off had left, as you do. So they'd gone, yeah, and we didn't have cell phones or anything like that. So I just turned around and came back to New Zealand. And so that those sort of next 4 or 5 years were incredible, you know, sort of moments in my life that really shaped me. And I think for me, one of my biggest fears in life, Goldie, is I don't want to ever stop growing. And I want to continue to challenge myself to change and to be different and make sure that I'm growing, because it's all those moments in my life, some of them I wouldn't want to repeat, have always and continue to be making who I am today. And I don't think that should stop because of age. So I'm always pushing to try and find new moments and new experiences that TV was one, mate. I mean, you know, I think another really big moment in my life was, you know, the complete failure at the Blues. And people say, oh, JK, it wasn't failure. Well, in our industry, it was, you know. You got to win. If you don't win, you get the sack. And I resigned an hour before they sacked me, which is just good for the CV. But another incredible moment in my life. Reflection, scary, don't know what I'm going to do. You know, and then came and did some stuff with you, really scary, never been much on TV before. You were amazing. You do an amazing job. You really helped me sort of settle in. But then, okay, JK, are you going to be you on the TV show, or are you just going to be a talking head? So all these moments in my life that have often been scary at the time continue to make me grow and expand, which is, did that answer your question?
Yeah, we're always going to get to that point. You go, what was the question again? And so I love that about the fact, because I agree with you entirely that, you know, it feels like a lifetime ago. We quite often get asked whether or not, oh, do you miss it? We both agree we don't miss it, I think. We see what they do out there now and we go, you know what? That's not the game that we played, and we've moved on to other things. Do we miss it? Could, you know, if we could play, would we? I don't know. I may not, but I look at it and you're right. They were, I mean, I went and did other things and been part of other things, which I felt that I've probably got more growth out of as a person, an individual, and been able to challenge myself in different ways, you know. So when you leave the rugby environment, when you left, did you just know it was time? Did you think to yourself, you know what, I need a new challenge? And when it was the Warriors and rugby league, did, a bit like me, was it the I chased the cricket dream? Were you just chasing another dream?
Yeah, look, I think it's a really good question. It's a hard one to answer. So, you know, people often talk to me about failure, and I just don't believe in failure. And that came about really when I turned down the Warriors for the first time. So I turned down the Warriors for the first time, and then I'm lying in bed every night and I'm saying, what if? You know, what if I could make it in rugby? What if, what if, what if? And I remember after 2 months, you know, saying to my wife, I can't live with what if, because what if is way bigger than failure, right? So I don't want to be my age now, 56. Just imagine if I didn't go. I'm looking back and say, I wish I had done that. What if I had done that? And so that, and then Michael Jordan had just been through his softball experience. Yeah, and yeah. I did a bit of research on that. And I read an amazing article from him, which was pretty much similar. And so that was another pivotal time in my life. And you know, if you morph that to when I finished with the Blues, so two things. I don't believe in failure because I believe there are learnings. Because if you don't fail, then you're never pushing yourself to try and be, you know, this person that you want to be. So there's no such thing as what if. And then, if failures are learning, what did you learn from it? I have no regrets. The only little regret that I have, and as I continue to grow and try and get better and better, is looking back and at the mistakes I made as a rugby coach, right? At some of the things I did that I think were more ego-driven than ability-driven, you know, trying to do things that aren't really your strengths, right? And then trying to cover that with things that you shouldn't. So those types of things are incredible learnings. They're not failures. And failure motivates me, because once I've failed, I know that there's so many learnings there if I listen. I think the hardest thing across all these decisions, and, you know, doing TV was another one, doing the mental health ads many years ago, was how do you talk to your ego? You know, which part of this is good ego and which part of this is bad ego? And I think I continue to question that, you know. JK, do you do this because you actually like the fame, or don't you like the fame? Where's your ego sit in that? What is that driving you? Are you being egotistical about this opinion, or is it actually opinion that you've done a little bit of research about, you reflected it on yourself, and you've got the courage and the confidence to back that up? And I still make those mistakes sometimes, because I get passionate about things very quickly without thinking about them. And that's why sometimes, you know, I'll say to you, yeah, you're right, I'm wrong. Because I didn't actually go through that process, which, I mean, I'm not worried about it. It's just as
but the
is.
Nature of the positions you've been in, where you've had responsibility and you've been trying to lead, that belief and confidence that you're trying to give to other people, like you say, you have to demonstrate yourself. And like you say, that ego of, okay, do I have to have all of the answers? I remember when I was coaching the same, you know, when I transitioned across, it was very, very similar. The fact that you thought you were, you know, if you felt as though you were close to the answer, you'd give your opinion on it rather than, you know. And I remember when Liam Barry, I did some coaching with him, and he's now with the New Zealand Sevens team and doing a fantastic job with them. I mean, he talked to me about the fact, if you don't have an answer, just say, I'll go away and I'll talk to somebody about that, and I'll get back to you, you know, and give yourself that opportunity. And I mean, you talk about coaching, you coach the Azzurri, you coach the Brave Blossoms, Japan, Italy, and the Blues. I mean, were those still, you talk about all those, that learning that you did. I mean, were they really important parts of your life? And like you say, we all have the benefit of hindsight. We have done things differently. But were they, as experiences for you, still something special you hold on to?
Oh, all of them were amazing. And just getting back to that leadership question that you mentioned, you know, leadership is grey. It's not black and white. So when you are deciding in grey, there are going to be mistakes made. And I think, you know, Liam, who's also a good mate of mine, you know, is right. If you don't know, you should fess up. Or if you are trying to push the boundaries, you need to take everyone with you, right? But when you talked about growing situations, you know, I remember going to see my dad and saying, Dad, I've got an opportunity to go and play rugby in Japan, right? So this is very, very early days in, you know, what Japan was. So no one knew anything about Japan. There were a few players. Joe Stanley was up there. There was a few players up there, but it was still pretty in its infancy. And I remember going to saying, gee, I never thought I'd play in Japan, you know. And he said to me, you know, son, at my age, so he would have been probably 75 or 78, he said, when you look back on life at my age, 3 years is nothing. So whether it's a good or bad experience, when you're at my age, it'll be an experience, right? And so that gave me the courage to go and do that. And it was the most amazing time of my life. Still got great mates there. So then I think one of the things I'm really passionate about doing with my new company, Mentimeter, is actually creating something for players that are about to finish. Because you would have faced this, and you asked me this question before, you know, why the Warriors? I was probably bored in rugby. I probably should have done what Tana did and gone from wing to centre to try and challenge myself. You know, I was getting a bit old and a bit bitter. So the challenge of the Warriors was amazing. The challenge of going to Japan was amazing. But then at the end of that, I didn't know what I was going to do, right? So I'm a butcher. I know I'm not going to have to do that. You know what I mean? And, I'd only been a pro for 5 years. So I'd had 2 years with the Warriors and then 3 years in Japan. So I was very disciplined in those years. And so I paid off a mortgage. So I didn't, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of debt, but I didn't have any income. So what do you bloody do? And I think this is really, really difficult for players because we are 35 and we have been the best at what we do, regardless of what level you get to, because anyone who plays professionally is the best at what they do, whether you make the All Blacks or not, you're the best at what you do. And so how do you become the best at something else? And what is that? And that is a really, really scary time. And I only knew one thing, and that was rugby. And I got the opportunity to go into management with the Blues, with Gordy Hunter, good mate of yours. And, you know, that was an incredible roller coaster ride as well. I was manager. He got unwell. There's a whole lot of things going on in the background that were
It was a roller coaster to play for him as well. He was a beautiful man, but I'm sure you had your challenges.
Yeah, but anyway, all those moments, you know, all those moments that keep pushing you. But then coaching the Italian side was an absolutely amazing experience. You know, I'd had a group of young guys who were really passionate and we had a hell of a lot of fun. We won some really important games that kept me for there a few years. And then, you know, I went for the, at the end of that, I went for the Japanese job. You know, and the American job at the same time and chose the Japanese job. And that was just a fantastic experience. I was really disappointed with the way we performed in the World Cup here in New Zealand. We should have beaten France at North Harbour Stadium. And there was a couple of things in that game where if things had have gone a little bit different, it would have been a special moment and the players deserved it. But that was an amazing growth. You know, we went from 18th in the world to 11th. I learned a lot about myself and coaching. And so those years coaching were fantastic. Coming home to the Blues, you know, I loved it for 2.5 years. The last probably half year wasn't great, but I really, really enjoyed being back in New Zealand and having a crack. It was my goal and dream. And I think, you know, often my kids will ask me, you know, Dad, what if we don't make this team or make that team? But, you know, I think understanding your level and having a crack is way better than, like I said before, saying what if, you know. My goals were to be the best coach that I could be, coming back to New Zealand, coaching the Blues and making them successful would put me in that top rung. Didn't work out, but, hey, I knew my level. And looking back, I know exactly my level. You know, if I ever got back into coaching, which won't happen, I'd know exactly what to do. And I think that's really important. A lot of coaches, after their failure, I think in coaching you can have two failures, right? You can't have three. You know, like I love Jose Mourinho, who's obviously been an amazing coach. You know, Chelsea, Portugal, Man United, Tottenham, and now he's in Rome. And I was talking to someone the other day and they're saying, you know, it's an important season for him to win because he's been the most amazing coach. But if you have two failures in a row, it's really hard to get back. So a lot of coaches have left the Blues and got incredibly great knowledge out of it and gone on to be great coaches, you know.
Except you and me. Do you miss it? Oh, I'm saying that because, well, you got rid of me, which is probably, in some ways, I talk about it in hindsight, you know, it's probably the best thing that ever happened. It presented me with a different opportunity, a different challenge. And so you think about that. But do you miss that side of it? Because if there's one thing, you know, there's something special for me and always was, but when you're part of that team, when you're part of that insider sporting team, which rides the emotions, which you do as a rugby coach, every single week, when we're seeing Leon McDonald go through that with this Blues team right now. Do you miss elements of that? And you know, we don't miss sometimes the losing, but just that camaraderie, that changing room, because it is a special place to be.
No.
They don't?
No. I think my ego does.
Yeah.
I think my ego does. You know, I miss being center stage. I miss being in that competitive environment. I miss, you know, all those things you spoke about, the change room, the camaraderie, the inner sanctum. I probably miss a bit of that, but I don't think I had the mental capacity to be a coach. I don't think I could switch off, and I think I cared too much. And that's, I'm not saying that the coaches at the highest level don't care, because I think they do, but I think they have a ability to compartmentalize and leave that where it should be and carry on with life. I'd stay awake at night. I'd be worrying about individuals. I don't miss any of that side of it. I miss, and I'm disappointed that I didn't, under pressure, I didn't understand my incredible strengths and really implement them and get the people around me that would really, really help with my deficiencies. I remember Murray Mixted saying to me very plainly, you know, JK, your problem was you learned how to coach overseas. And if you want to do it in New Zealand, she's a pretty hard road to get where you already are. And the second thing was I came back after being away for 12 years. I didn't know any players. And so there was a whole lot of different things that I would change, I think. But, hey, look, I mean, this is the only time I've thought about it, Golda, because I just do not look back, you know, like I keep moving forward. And like I said, don't believe in failure. I just believe in learnings and moving on and putting those learnings into other parts of your life.
Mate, you mentioned your kids. So Francesca plays professional beach volleyball. She does. Nico plays professional football. And Luca's in a New Zealand junior rower. So they've all got some big engines, obviously.
Yeah, no, he just made the elite side yesterday.
So, okay. Did they all get the same competitive drive? Or has it been, I mean, you talk about
probably
that.
Well,
I've heard discussions with you and Fiorella, and I'll tell you what, it's passionate. There's no doubt about that. But if you think about, you know, the path that they've gone down, and these are not easy sports to play. These are challenging sports. I mean, what's your advice been to them? And how have you found it, knowing that they are feeling pressure of sorts, different pressure to what you've felt, and how have you helped them grow into the sports they're playing?
Well, I'm incredibly proud of the people they are, firstly. I genuinely love my kids and like them, if you can have both of those things. Francesca is an incredible young woman. She is running our wine business, but also New Zealand volleyball champ, tried to qualify for the Olympics, missed out, now in Europe. And she is just an incredibly motivated and driven person who also is a fantastic daughter. So that's all you can ask for, right? And Nico, my son, who plays football, never picked up a rugby ball in his life. He's done an amazing job, you know, had a tough time here in New Zealand in the initial stages when I brought him back from Italy. And then, a bit like me when I was 20, he just got on a plane and trialed, and it's been a really tough road for him, but he's hung in there and, you know, he's getting some success now, which is fantastic. And Luca, who was playing rugby, but then chose rowing, that is the hardest sport in the world. Anyone who rows, you guys are going to go well. So I think the message that we had as parents is, you know, we would never take, we felt as parents that sport was as important as education from a learning point of view, right? So we felt that, for example, if they're not doing well at school, we're not going to take their sport off them, right? Why would you do that? And also, we just encourage them to be the best that they can be. And what does that look like? So keep pushing. And what often happens was, you know, they hit a bit of a wall and want to change direction, or, you know, start lacking a bit of confidence. We would try and encourage them to push through that, right? And make sure that they challenge themselves. I think competitiveness, you know, both Frella and I are competitive. She's probably more competitive than me. And so I think that's genetics. I think the hardest thing, it's not been hard for us to motivate them to try and be the best. Self-doubt, believing in yourself, all those types of things are all things that I and Frella, we try and help with, because I think those are the things that, you know, especially I suffered from, you know, and how you try and educate your kids from a sporting point of view about some of the stuff that you went through. It's very different to parenting, I believe. There's parenting and core values and discipline and things that we have an expectation around. And then there's actually trying to parent a child around their sport. And I think they're very different techniques, and not easy if you've been to a certain level. You know, I remember saying to Nico once, who was on the bench, and I said, well, mate, I can't advise you, because I was always picked. And, you know, this, I don't want that to sound arrogant, but it was the truth. So I was really, really fortunate. Like, I always got picked. And I remember reacting incredibly badly, like when I was 32 and they dropped me in Japan. I acted like a spoiled little shit, right? So yeah. I could not advise. I could not advise on what he needed at the time from a sports point of view. But, you know, it's one of the most exciting things I have in my life is watching my kids play sport. I think it's just one of the greatest things that that you can do as a parent. But yeah, you know,
not as exciting when I hear you talk about the fact you're heading down Start Highway 1 and then you're heading towards Waihee, and you know you've got your crew of guys there that you're going to go and, is that where you go and check out? You go to the batch, you know, I know half of the Waikato and former players have all moved out there, and there's Smitty's around, and I mean, but in saying that, when you get there, do you still get sucked into a little bit of rugby talk, a little bit of rugby chat, and you know the fact that, you know, because that's the familiarity. Warren Gatz is around. You know, you think about the people. But for you, is that where you talk about family and friends and escaping, you know, all of this seriousness of life?
There's a beautiful word in Maori called ukaipo, and I believe directly translated, it might mean something like breastfeeding or something like that. But it also has another meaning of where you belong. And when I was creating the JK Foundation and the program Mighty to go into school, we did it on some of the Maori sort of ways of well-being, and this word ukaipo came up. And when the lady that built this program explained it to me, she said, I feel ukaipo when I see my land, which is up north. When I come over the hill and I see my land, I feel automatically at home and at peace. And Waihee is like that for me. I come down the hill and I see the sea and the Waihee town or Waihee Beach Township in front of me, and I automatically feel at home and at peace. And I think that's a really, really special really, really special feeling and something. And I actually, like people say to me, you know, when I talk about Italy, I talk about home. And my place in Italy, I feel that that's home as well. So I feel really fortunate that I have more than one ukaipo. And so for me, when I go to Waihee, it is about that. And so when I'm at peace, but like rugby is in my blood. Like if I sit there and talk about rugby, I'm happy. Like it's not that I don't want to talk about rugby, you know. And so for me, Wayne Smith's down there, you know, like he rings me, hey, I've just got down there, and he goes, what are you doing, Jack? It's Saturday afternoon. Like I'm just chilling, man. I've had a surf. Life's good. Thinking about what I'm going to have, you know, for dinner, what sort of wine I'm going to drink. And Smithy rings me, says, what are you doing, Jack? And I said, mate, I'm cruising. He said, do you want to come and watch Waihee Beach play? Waihee Township? Waihee Athletic play? I've been coaching them. I said, Smithy, are you kidding yourself? Like, are you kidding yourself?
And did he goes, go?
No, no. So I went with him. It was amazing. I did. It was amazing. I saw a whole lot of Waihee Beach people who I know. Gary Wetton was there. John Burns was there. Stephen Barclay was there, all guys that I played with in my era. Yeah. They were there just by chance, you know, and it was just a really cool afternoon. And it is an integral part of our community that I'm really scared that is starting to break down. You know, so that for me was just a great day. but also I do like to get down there, and I don't watch TV. I don't, you know, sort of get away from it as well.
Yeah, look, just lastly, I just want to talk about, you know, obviously, you know, in more recent years, I mean, you've talked about your struggles with mental health, but the role that you've come to play in New Zealand, the fact that the things that you have to deal with and trying to change on a daily basis, I mean, is that now for you in terms of a priority? Has that become your life's priority in terms of the fact that that's how you really want to make a difference, is by helping people and helping them cope with, like you've talked about, some of the things that have changed and are different in today's society?
Yeah, look, for me, I think there's some beautiful people out there who are talking about it, and more people talking about, you know, Mike King's doing a great job. I love what he's doing. Jazz Thornton's doing doing an amazing job. There's a lot of people now out there talking about it. So, you know, I'm really pleased that there's more voices out there. I think, you know, I've done two things. I've started a company called Mentimere, and that's really about well-being in the workplace and delivering that. We want to help 100 million people and save 100,000 lives. And that, for me, delivering well-being into the workplace and mental well-being and psychological well-being is really, really important, because I think that we need to learn these tools now, right? We get more inputs in one day today than we than our grandparents had in a lifetime. So we've got to learn some of these techniques that I learned by being unwell, you know. So that is really, really important for me. And then the other thing that I've created for the JK Foundation is a program called Mighty, which is teaching our children at school how to learn about the IQ and the EQ of their mental health. And I'm really, really passionate about that. I've had some beautiful people that have given me, you know, a lot of money, and we are now in 20 schools, hopefully to be in 70 schools by next year. And that is teaching our kids all those tools, all the things they need to understand mental health so that they can deal with some of the things that life's going to throw at them. So, you know, really my goal is prevention. And I think that prevention of what I went through is what I would like to deliver now. I also think with Mentimere that it needs to be a business. It needs to be a for-profit. I think it's really, really hard to keep asking for money. So the idea about Mentimere is create a business model where businesses get more retention. They get more, you know, they get better people staying. They get more productivity. They get less absenteeism. So things like that, if we can prove mental well-being in the workplace, we'll do that. Then it becomes a norm, Goldie. Like, I don't want it to be this thing, you know. I just want it to be something normal that we all talk about, that we understand, that we educate for, and so that then, you know, we can go from one of the worst, you know, suicide and mental health stats in the developed world to the best. So that's my goal, to go from one of the worst to the best.
Yeah, and we're grateful for all of the time that you put into that. And in fact, I know that for all of those charities that are looking for someone to volunteer to do some sort of physical challenge, Sir John Kerwin is your man, whether he's biking or swimming. He usually puts his hand up every year. He's looking for a new challenge. Have we got one when we come out of lockdown, JK? Is that what we're thinking about?
No, well, if I remember last time, there was two people who were brought up in Southland who
That's
promised
right.
to do the ride with me next year. But
hold on. You promised that we would do it. I didn't promise. You promised.
Yeah, no, I promised for you. Yeah.
Well, on my behalf, I'm not sure I agreed to that. JK, look, we have so much admiration. It's a pleasure to work with you because of the fact you bring so much passion to what we do, and we love what we do, and it's great. On a weekly basis, we get to debate and discuss and try and make people aware and make things in our sport better. But you're obviously doing that on a bigger scale. So, mate, always great to have a chat. We'll do it on a Monday night once again when the breakdown is on. But once again, thanks very much, mate. And let's do this again sometime.
Yeah, thanks, Goldie. Look, I think, you know, one of the greatest things in life is friendship. And you and I probably didn't know each other that well before we started television, but I had huge respect for you as a player before, but I regard you as a mate now and someone who I can talk to about just about anything. And I think in life, if you can have a professional situation where you end up saying, well, he's a good mate of mine, then I think that is really, really special. So thanks for the interview. I forget a lot of these things that we talk about. I just take them as granted in my past and don't talk about them a lot. So it's been a bit of a walk down memory lane for me as well. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a walk.
Definitely a good thing. Definitely a good thing. Let's do it again. Cheers, mate.